opposed. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 85759, Marilyn versus Garrison. General Sachs, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court, we are here on a writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which reversed the conviction of Respondent Garrison because, in the judgment of the Maryland Court of Appeals, the evidence necessary to sustain that conviction was the product of an unconstitutional search of Respondent Garrison's apartment. The search and seizure warrant in question, issued by a district court judge, state judge in Baltimore, issued for the person of one Lawrence McWebb, a suspected marijuana dealer, and his premises, 2036 Park Avenue, third floor apartment. It was issued, we believe respondent concedes, with ample probable cause for McWebb and for that search. It was issued, however, on the assumption and executed on the assumption that only one apartment existed on the third floor of 2036 Park Avenue, and it was the apartment of McWebb. Turned out that that assumption was, in the words of Hill v. California, quite wrong. There were two apartments, one McWebb's, the other Garrison's, and the question before the Court is whether the police behavior here in this case falls within the margin for reasonable error allowable by the Fourth Amendment as recognized in opinions of this Court like Hill against California and Brinegar and in others. We submit that the conduct of the police here clearly does fall within that reasonableness standard. It's helpful, we think, Your Honors, to analyze what the police did here in three separate stages. The investigation stage, which led to the obtaining and issuance of the warrant. The arrival at 2036 Park Avenue, arrival at the premises, and finally, the entry into the third floor premises themselves. Each of these stages reinforced, we submit, the assumption at the beginning that there was one apartment on the third floor and it was McWebb's. And each of these stages, we also submit, Your Honors, was dominated by a crucial fact, an overwhelming fact, a central fact that characterized each stage. In the first stage, the verification from the public utility, the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, that there was only one apartment on the third floor, and that was McWebb's. At the second stage, it was the arrival of McWebb himself, the very subject of the intended subject of the search, who arrived on the scene fortuitously. He had been out of his apartment, came to the scene, and in effect led the officers up the stairs. And finally, in the third stage, it was the appearance of the premises once the police went through the door, which we suggest gave the appearance for all the world that this is one apartment and only one apartment. Now, the facts begin with a tip from an informant of Officer Marcus that the informant had been buying marijuana for a long time, I believe 6 months, from someone he knew as Red Cross, street name Red Cross, from his apartment on the third floor of 2036 Park Avenue. The informant said nothing about the existence on that floor of two separate apartments. The informant had bought marijuana as recently as the day before Officer Marcus proceeds to get his affidavit. Officer Marcus then does an eminently reasonable thing. He checks with, first he looks at the premises, sees that it's a three-story brick building with 2036 on the outside, which the informant had said, and then he checks with the public utility. He calls up the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company to find out who lived on the third floor. All he had was the street name, Red Cross. And he recites in his affidavit for the warrant that he called and he discovered, he says the word discovered, that the premises 2036 third floor was in the name of Lawrence McWebb. He, on examination at the motion to suppress, Officer Marcus says he expressly asked Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, was there a front and a middle and a back, or words very much to that effect. And they told me, and this is a quote from Marcus in the suppression hearing, they told me, he says, one third floor was only listed to Lawrence McWeb. Not perhaps the most grammatical or artful expression of what we think the evidence is clear. It meant what he was saying was, there's only one guy who lives there, there's only one apartment. Of McWeb to the informant, he says, that's Red Cross, and Marcus gets his warrant. It is difficult, may I suggest, at this stage, Your Honor, to imagine a police officer acting more reasonably under the precedence of this court and the preference for the warrant requirement and the reasons for it in the first place. Of course, he could have done more. He could have checked with the phone company, I suppose. He could have made supplementary checks. But the mistake here was the mistake, we suggest, of BG&E. It was not the mistake of the police. His reliance on that mistake was appropriate and was consistent with the informant. There was no reason to question, and the BG&E was indeed the verification, as the Court of Special Appeals in this case held, the verification of the information that he needed. Stage two is the arrival at the premises, 2036, of the police raiding party. While Officer Shea, one of the first officer on the scene, was examining the outside door to the premises, the exterior door that led to the street, and was trying to gain entry into that door without breaking it down. At one point he said he punched all seven bells to try to get somebody to press the release buzzer so he could get in without breaking down the door. While that's going on, and incidentally he testified and the court found as a fact that McWeb's name was at none of those bells, while that's going on, who should arrive but McWeb himself by vehicle? He is detained, of course. He's informed of the search warrant, of course. And what then happens is he leads the raiding party. His key is used to open the exterior door. He leads the raiding party up into the first floor, onto the second floor landing, onto the third floor, and it's his key that opens the door to the third floor apartment, as it appeared to the police at that time. Significantly, on the way up and throughout this entire episode, McWeb never says, "My apartment is third floor rear." Never does he indicate that there are two apartments. Never, as we will see in a moment, does Garrison so indicate. But as they're going up these stairs, the police are also seeing on the first and the second floor, the evidence shows, doors leading from the landings to what must have appeared to them to be apartments. But when they get to the third floor, this is not the lady and the tiger. We are not here talking about options that the police have. There is one door and one door only on the third floor, appearing for all the world to them to be the door of the apartment of the man, McWeb, who is the subject of the search, who is now leading them into the premises itself. There's an interesting...
Well, unlike the appearances on the first and second floors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Officer Marcus, Shea does not recall in his testimony, Your Honor, whether there were or were not doors on the other floors. But Officer Marcus expressly, and we cite the references at page 10 of our reply brief, expressly talks about there being other doors, quote, unquote, a lot of doors, quote, unquote. Well, I think he's talking about the second floor in particular, perhaps the first, but certainly at the third. I think he's talking mostly the second floor, options. But on the third, one door and one door only. In an exchange between counsel for Garrison, the respondent, and Officer Shea at the motion to suppress, counsel says, well, didn't it occur to you, officer, that as you got to the third floor, there might be more than one apartment? Shea replies, not when I saw that one door, no. It's also important, we suggest, Your Honors, to remember this in analyzing this case. This is not a situation in which the police should have been expected to ask as they were proceeding, should we, shouldn't we? This was not analysis of where are we each stage of the way. They had a valid warrant, as far as they knew. They were proceeding up the stairs with the very subject of that warrant. There was not a reason for them to be self-examining their conduct because nothing had gone off to alert them of the need to do so. And so here we have, at stage two, the arrival at the moment of truth led by the very subject of the search itself. And now we come through the door. It is the key of McWeb that allows them to come in, although Officer Marcus recalled that he thought Garrison himself might have opened the door. But what they see when they come in further ratifies and reinforces the assumption that they had been making from the beginning, the validity of this warrant for the one apartment on the third floor. On the right, they enter a tiny foyer, 4 by 5 feet is, I think, the description in the appendix in our petition for certiorari is a diagram, appendix page 44 in the petition for certiorari. But what they see in this, they're in this small, tiny foyer. And to their right, they see an open doorway with a bedroom. To their left, they see an open doorway with a living room. And no doors were visible. That is a finding of fact by the trial court in this case. No doors were visible. In fact, as it turns out, there were doors to those two doorways, the bedroom and the living room, but they were wide open and they opened inward. And the evidence is, as I say, the court found as a fact, that no doors were visible. May I also add at this point, Your Honors, that it is not unreasonable that it should have seemed to them to be a one premises occupied by a common one apartment. It is, after all, and as a matter of record in this case, that this had been a building, as many buildings on that block are. This had been a building that had been a one-family building. This building was built for one family and had been broken down into apartments. But I suggest to you that you should not have in your mind the notion of some corridor with doors going off to various apartments. So you have these only the two doors, and the two doors are wide open with no doors visible at all. The two doorways are wide open. And lo and behold, directly in front of them, not in what turned out to be his apartment, not even in the bedroom that they saw on their right, but directly in front of them is the respondent Garrison. He is in pajamas, and he is in a body cast because he had recent spinal surgery. He is asked to identify himself, and he does. He is silent with respect to, wait a minute now, I'm a neighbor here. This is not, I don't know, what are you doing here in my place? He's absolutely silent on that question. He's detained and taken off to the living room thing that I described on the left. And the police at this moment see, as they're into this tiny car, they see marijuana on the bureau in the bedroom, what they think is marijuana, on the bureau in the bedroom of Garrison. The very thing they had the probable cause to believe was being sold by McWebb from his apartment, they now see in a bedroom on a bureau 5-6 feet away from where they were. It is reasonable. It is reasonable, we suggest. And that is the standard, and we suggest the only standard that needs apply here, for the police to have assumed that Garrison was a housemate, Garrison was a roommate, Garrison was a convalescing cousin come to call. He was not a neighbor who had some independent living arrangement over there. Now, there were other indicia that developed in the course of this episode that are more ambiguous in terms of their timing. But they cut very much in favor of the state. The phone in Garrison's bedroom on the right rings. It's a phone call for Red Cross, McWebb. Clothes are found hanging on what was the exterior door to Garrison's apartment, the one on the right.
Mr. Attorney General, looking at this diagram, you have Garrison's name here at the right, a bedroom. Is that the entire apartment?
No, Your Honor, the entire apartment, as it turns out, and as the police, as they did their securing tour of the premises, later discovered, but only after the heroin was discovered in the bedroom. The entire apartment, Your Honor, would be the bedroom of Garrison, would be what is marked bedroom. The living room immediately behind it is Garrison's, is the living room of that apartment. You see a kitchen then on the left and a bathroom. Indeed, it was when the sergeant saw two kitchens as he went through this entire operation and noticed that there was the opportunity, the two bathrooms with an opportunity to lock a bolt that was open, but nonetheless he saw that.
But did you have to get into Garrison's apartment by that common stairway?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
You did.
Oh, absolutely. The only way to get into Garrison's apartment was through the doorway, wide open as I described, that shows immediately to the right of the stairs.
But did you have to pass through the other apartment to get into Garrison's?
No, Your Honor. Absolutely not. The two apartments turn out to be, as an apartment on the right, Garrison's, an apartment on the left, McWebb's. The point is that we didn't realize that...
General Sachs will resume there at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.
We'll resume argument where we left off, General Sachs.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court, until the discovery, as I was attempting to explain to Mr. Justice Brennan before the break, until the discovery by the police of the two kitchens and the two bathrooms, and until it became apparent to the searching party that this may well be two apartments, at which point the search ceased, an assistant state's attorney was called, and the search was terminated. Until that point, it is our position that nothing about the scene contradicted the assumption of the warrant. Everything about the scene, reasonably observable, that came to the senses of the police officers, confirmed the assumption of the warrant, the central assumption of this case, which is that there was one third-floor apartment, and it was McWebb's.
And yes, if I may. I thought there was only one door on the third floor.
There was.
Into the apartment?
There was one door, Mr. Justice, that led, only one door on the third floor that entered into what we now know to be the two apartments of McWebb and Garrison. It was a locked door, and it was through that door that McWebb's key and McWebb led the officers. That enters that one door, as opposed to the second and first floors where there are many doors. That one door, and I'm referring here to the petition for certiorari appendix, page 44, that one door leads into a very small foyer. It's marked hallway.
Off which there are doors?
Off which there are doors, but at the moment they entered, all the police saw, so the court found, was two doorways, not even doors, two doorways, the one on the right into Garrison's bedroom and what we now know to be his apartment, and on the left into McWebb's. In fact, Mr. Justice Brennan, we now know that the door on the right, once we're into the third floor now, the door on the right was, in fact, the door to a Garrison apartment. The door on the left was a door into a McWebb apartment.
I just want to be...
Well, there were doorways, and all that was visible to the police were doorways. In fact, there were doors, but they were fully opened, and they opened inward so that they were not visible to the searching officers. Indeed, Mr. Justice Scalia, the evidence is that at some point during the presence of the police officers in the Garrison bedroom, they noticed the door finally, and there were clothes hanging on its exterior, so that the police was a further indicia. We suggest that this was not a separate apartment. Who hangs clothes over the outside door to one's own apartment? We don't press it too hard, frankly, sir, because it's a little ambiguous as to the precise point at which they noticed that particular feature. We ask this, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. You know, it's customary for counsel such as myself in defense of searches by police in the argument of reasonableness to invoke, to really plea for understanding from courts because of the obvious tenseness of the situations, because of the danger of the situations, because of the kind of considerations this court recognized in Michigan against Summers and others, the split second, the need for split second decision making. All of that is true here. And of course we urge that those considerations be part of the analysis of the court. But we have so much more here. We are not left with only those indulgences that we ask of courts for police conduct. We had a warrant. These police had a warrant that they believed to be valid, and they reasonably believed it to be valid, and they reasonably believed that they were executing it valid.
Well, what do you do with the what do you do with the judicial finding that the warrant covered only McWebb's apartment?
The Court of Appeals.
How did the Court of Appeals know it covered only Webb's apartment?
Court of Appeals, with all respect to it, from hindsight, that's how, Mr. Justice White. The Court of Appeals.
Maybe the officers should have told.
What is striking about the Court of Appeals opinion, Mr. Justice White, is that it absolutely eschews any analysis of reasonableness whatsoever. It's precisely the vice of the Court of Appeals opinion that it incants a conclusion. You did not have a warrant for the premises. There was no warrant for the search in Hill. It is always after the fact. One can always say, if one finds fault, one can say, with respect to any such analysis, there was no warrant. The point here is, did they reasonably believe they had a valid warrant? The issue in this case, sir, is whether or not the mistake made by the police was reasonable. That's an analysis the Court of Appeals never made.
Well, suppose that it would have been perfectly clear to anybody that there were two apartments on the third floor.
Then we should have lost this case, and we would not be arguing what we're here arguing. The Court of Appeals did not conclude that it would have been or should have been reasonable to anyone. The trial court found reasonableness. The Court of Special Appeals affirmed that finding. The Court of Appeals never asked the question. And that's
well, the warrant question. Actually authorized a search of the the premises of McWebb, didn't it? At 2036 Park Avenue, third floor apartment.
In fact, that was its intention clearly.
Is that what it said?
What it said literally, Mr. Justice White, is this. For the person of, there's a printed warrant that's at the beginning, you'll find it in the joint appendix at page 4.
Right.
It reads for the person of, and then the name McWebb is there.
Yes.
And then it says, for the premises known as, it doesn't say his, it simply says, for the premises known as 2036 Park Avenue, third floor apartment. There is no question that the assumption of the warrant and of the officers was that, and the intention was only to search McWebb's apartment. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. If they had known of a Garrison apartment,
but does,
2A.
Does the warrant tell you that you're entitled to search, that the assumption is that McWebb lives on the whole third floor or not?
The warrant doesn't address literally that, sir, but the warrant's assumption is, the affidavit recites the information received from the gas and electric company. The warrant assumes without stating, but it was the clear assumption of the warrant, that the McWebb apartment in question was the third floor.
And obviously, if they had arrived at the third floor and there actually was only one apartment, you could have searched the whole apartment.
Exactly so. And had they arrived at the third floor and suddenly found two closed doors, one of which said McWebb and the other Garrison, they should not have known
which one to search.
Absolutely.
But now they arrived, it's just like there was only one apartment.
That's
because
exactly.
It was reasonable to think so.
Yes, sir. It was reasonable to get the warrant on that assumption. It was reasonable to assume it going up those stairs.
So this is just no violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Precisely so.
You don't have to get any farther.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Like Hill.
Precisely like Hill, and exactly as in Hill. Officers, the recognition that officers... mistakes can be understandable. Sufficient probability, not certainty, is the touchstone of reasonableness, as this Court said. And that's precisely the doctrine that we think need to be applied here. This is not a case for new doctrine. This is not a case for extension of any present doctrine. This is not a case for newfangled, some would call it newfangled notions. This is an old-fashioned traditional reasonable.
You argue in the alternative, as I read your brief, that this is a reasonable search and therefore not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And B, this is a reasonable search, and therefore you're entitled to good faith exception.
Well,
in your view, is there a difference in the test of reasonableness under the two different arguments?
In this, certainly not in a case that involves an alleged mistake of fact. It is the heart of our position that when you were addressing the issue of the reasonableness or not of a factual mistake, there is no difference whatsoever between the merits test and the good faith test. If the police... reasonably, with objective reasonableness, the language of Leon, believed here that there was one apartment and only one, and it was McWebb's, then there was no Fourth Amendment violation. We don't have to get into the problem of the different voices that has been discussed in some of the dissents in Leon, in a dissent in Leon, with respect to this issue. This case, other cases may present the question of how and under what circumstances the police can be said to be objectively reasonable, notwithstanding the fact of a Fourth Amendment violation. Leon and Shepard do that very thing. That, we urge, Your Honors.
Making a mistake that these facts add up to probable cause.
The legal judgment is a much tougher situation. Where Leon goes from here with respect to analyzing the police's good faith, objective reasonableness, and making legal conclusions is a problem, but not a problem for us, we respectfully suggest, in this case. This is a mistake of fact case. It is Hill. It is heavily influenced by, if not controlled by, the decision in Hill. Room, this Court said in Brinegar, must be allowed for reasonable mistakes on the part of police officers. Such reasonable mistake was made here, and we think that the judgment of the Maryland Court of Appeals, which never even asked the question of reasonableness, should be reversed. I'd like to reserve, unless
Attorney General, yes. Not that it matters this case. You remember what block of Park Avenue this was?
2036 Park Avenue. It is just below the reservoir, Mr. Justice Marshall. Yeah. It's now known, I think, as Reservoir Hill.
Thank you, General Sachs. We'll hear next from you, Mr. Krupp.
Mr. Chief Justice and Honorable Justices of the Court, good afternoon. This case and this Court has struggled for over 70 years in a very deep, dramatic, and legal mind, losing legal minds throughout these years to try and balance what we're trying to do today. On the one side, we want that Fourth Amendment where it says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures to still be viable. But on the other hand, we do not want to handcuff the police to such an extent that it's going to frustrate them and deter them the opposite way from going ahead and trying to ferret out criminals and be brought to justice by using evidence that's recovered against them. Now, in this great back-and-forth stress ever since weeks to the present time, many positions have been taken. As a defense lawyer, my heyday was back in the Warren Court. Today, I find it a much more difficult uphill battle the way the court is leaning. But that's fine. We have to adjust. But the court is still desperately trying to strike this balance. And I think if you step back from what the court has done, I think the court very clearly, during its period of time over this 70-some years, has said that warrantless searches, and you still say warrantless searches, are per se unreasonable. The touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, indeed, is reasonable, because the Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. So the question is this an unreasonable search? And we submit, without any equivocation, it is, because it was indeed a warrantless search. To say that they had a warrant for Garrison's apartment would be just picking themselves up by its own bootstraps. If, for instance, the police would have gone with a warrant into the wrong place first, and then they discovered it went into the right place, nobody would have a problem with that, because the warrant indeed was for McWebb. If the police didn't really know where to go, and there was, say, only one apartment and nothing was seized from Garrison, because it said McWebb, and as Justice White pointed out, the affidavit clearly says McWebb and third floor. An inference is there. What is the inference? The person to be seized is that person who lives at that apartment on the third floor. So this indeed was a warrantless search. Sure, they had a warrant.
But may I just interrupt for a second?
Certainly.
Mr. Krupp, as I read the warrant, which I think, incidentally, is on page 9, not page 4, of the joint appendix, the premises, as the description of the premises known as 2036 Park Avenue, third floor apartment, described as a three-story building with the numerals 2036.
That's correct.
And so that they did search within the area described in the warrant.
They searched within the area described in the warrant, but they also, as General Sachs pointed out, there is a place on the warrant. Indeed, the affidavit, which we can incorporate by reference, mentions McWebb.
Yeah, but it doesn't say the premises.
No, it does not.
It doesn't associate the premises with him.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So
what they were looking for, truly, we know for a fact, was McWebb's premises, not Garrison's or not anybody else's.
Well, didn't the Maryland courts read the warrant as authorizing only the search of McWebb's apartment?
You know what the Maryland courts, Justice White?
What about my question?
I don't think so.
All right.
Yes, they did. The answer is yes, and what they did, that's correct. What they did, without any equivocation, stated is what I just started with. Warrantless searches are per se unreasonable.
But there was
no warrant.
Because the warrant authorized only the search of McWebb's apartment.
That's correct. They felt very similarly to what I'm arguing to the court today, that because McWebb is mentioned and the affidavit, we can't forget that. That's the guts of why you get the warrant. It talks about McWebb. It describes him. The police knew who he was to such an extent when he walked up, they knew right away who he was.
Yes, but it also describes the premises the same way the warrant did.
That's correct. It says that the facts presented by General Sachs to you are absolutely correct. That is the finding. It describes a third-floor apartment. That's correct. What was wrong when Judge Landon signed the warrant, and what was wrong when they finally got to the third floor, it turned out to be two separate, distinct apartments, one belonging to Harold Garrison, which he has an absolute, unequivocal right against trespassing by police officers who are walking into his premises without a warrant. That was not the intention or the contemplation of the judge, nor was it the contemplation or the intention of the police officers when they entered the premises. They didn't go in looking for Garrison. They were looking for Mr. McWeb. They had him, he led him upstairs, and lo and behold, there they are. I'm not going to argue to this court, certainly as if it were a jury, but our Court of Appeals, when I argued the case, couldn't understand why the police, who can see around corners and see into bags that are opaque, couldn't see the numbers on the doors. They found trouble with that. They looked at this case as a self-serving, as a bootstrap case for the police to get themselves into a premises and to make a warrant sustain itself where it didn't belong. We're not deterring the police in this case.
Was McWeb ever arrested?
That's just what I was getting to, Justice Brennan. We're not deterring. Yes, he was. He was convicted. Why? Because our office who represented him pled him guilty. The warrant was good. The search was good, but of his apartment. And that's exactly my point. We're not deterring the police from frustration. We're not having them being frustrated because McWeb, the target, was brought to justice, pled guilty, was convicted, and met the full justice of the court below.
Mr. Kruth, what if an arrest warrant were put out for a specific individual and the police, in fact, arrested someone who matched the description but didn't turn out to be, in fact, the one arrested, and they search and in the process discover drugs?
Simple answer, I think.
Mistake of fact.
I think the
simple. Reasonable.
Yes.
Well, why don't we apply exactly the same sort of thing with the search of the premises?
Because the court never has. Well, the court has never elevated the citizen on the street.
Is there any reason not to?
Well, yes, because if you elevate the citizen on the street being arrested to the premises, which you never have, nor have you ever done it with a vehicle or a motor home, which Chief Justice Berger struggled to make a distinction between that mobile home and a vehicle, why struggle? The distinction is this, to answer it directly. Where will it lead? The police officer stops the policeman, the suspect on the street. He makes a mistake. Pursuant to that, under the common law in Schimel versus California, he searches. We say you cannot stop and frisk a house. Is that where it's going to lead? In other words, we talk about probable cause in the Fourth Amendment, and now we're diminished down to articulable, reasonable suspicion.
We're talking about a warrant and whether there's room for making a reasonable mistake.
I think
when all the outward circumstances would indicate there's one apartment on the third floor.
I think with the individual, without question, as to answer you, yes, because this court has seen fit that the individual does not have that same degree of protection under the Fourth Amendment, nor does a car, nor does anything traveling out on the street, including that mobile home again. So without any question, if you elevate it to the premises, you're taking away the very place where the human being, everybody can find sanctity.
Vigil?
This court has.
Well, you're saying it's a good thing. You're saying we should do it.
I think you should not. I think the individual on the street should be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures, the same as my premise.
You think Hill was wrong, basically?
Was it wrong, in my opinion? Yes. But the difference in Hill, let me go back to Hill for a minute to show you why. What happened in Hill, if you recall, is that when they arrested Hill and made the subsequent search, it wasn't of his person. It was way beyond his reach, lunge, or grasp, which would now violate Schimel versus California. So the whole crux of Hill would not even be viable today because Hill really didn't care about being arrested. He cared about the evidence that was used against him. That evidence was out of his reach, lunge, or grasp. And under Schimel versus California, this court would say, nice try, but you went too far.
Well, that's the only reason you think it's wrong.
No, I don't. I think the Fourth Amendment.
You think the arrest shouldn't have been allowed, too.
I think the Fourth Amendment says what it says. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, in their houses, in their papers, and their effects. The court has made the distinction. I live by it.
From unreasonable searches and seizures.
That's correct.
You acknowledge that you can wrongfully issue a warrant because you think that the warrant's proper, and in fact it's not proper, nonetheless.
There's a big distinction in that, too, Justice Scalia. Let me say why. When you go to get a warrant from a detached, neutral magistrate, a policeman is doing precisely what this court for 70-some years has begged him to do and urged him to do. He went to that neutral and detached magistrate, and when he went there, he gave the magistrate, with his knowledge, the opportunity to act as a buffer between the overzealous police, that defense would always argue, and the citizens' rights. So we have that protection. Justice O'Connor touched on that very thing in the first case today of Kroll. In a statute, for instance, in Kroll, we have at least the legislature intervening, using their knowledge and wisdom to give guidance to a policeman. At least we have that. But in this case, we have the unbridled sole judgment of a police officer trying to do his job in good faith.
Mr. Crewe, let's take this step by step, and you tell me when the police went wrong. When they went up to the house at the front door.
So far, so good.
And when the man gave him the key, so good.
McWebb, incidentally, was named in the warrant.
Are you okay?
Yes. Oh, absolutely, yes.
We go up to the third floor, he's still okay.
Yes.
And he opens the one door with the key.
Yes.
He's okay. Now, where did he go wrong?
Went wrong the moment he walked in through that threshold of that house that this court has always held above everything else.
Well,
how did he
know that was wrong?
Didn't know. Were we to reward him for his mistake? He didn't have probable cause. And that's the Constitution says, probable cause. Now when he walks in with a blunder, we're saying we're going to reward a blunder. If the surgeon cuts off the wrong arm, we don't reward him.
This court has said the blunder is not enough.
The blunder of the, most respect, of the magistrate.
That's right.
There's a difference because you had that neutral.
Oh, you say the error now is the magistrate?
I'm sorry, sir.
The error was the magistrate.
No, not in this case. No.
Well, I'm talking about this case.
In this case, the error,
even though in
good faith, was the police.
If they'd gone in the other door, it would have been okay.
Absolutely. Because McWebb, by inference, by the affidavit, we can't disregard the affidavit or the fact that it mentioned McWebb. We're talking about a man's house. We're not talking about his car, which is subject to licensing and regulation. We're not talking about walking on the street.
Man has given his key.
No, that's McWebb. McWebb did not give the key to Garrison's apartment. Garrison's apartment was open to the police because his door was open.
Did Garrison's apartment have a separate key?
Did Garrison ever accept the key?
Did Garrison's apartment have a separate key?
I believe it was clear, that, not on the record, but I think it's very clear without any equivocation that they were two separate, absolutely distinct apartments.
With the same door.
With the same common door.
The same lock.
Well, most respectfully,
the same lock and the same key.
Now, let me say this to answer to that.
Is that correct or not?
Correct.
Thank you.
Also on the first floor, all seven apartments had the same door with the same lock and the same key. By your analysis, most respectfully, we cannot draw an inference that they could walk into all seven.
Closed and for all we know, lockable.
That's true. I'm not arguing the facts. I'm not saying that the police didn't act reasonably. I think they did, as far as what was in front of them.
Mr. Krupp, it's no big deal in this case. I mean, you're just talking about a little bit of marijuana, right? But
your
argument would be the same had they found walking into the wrong apartment, which they thought was the right one. They're behaving properly, and they find a murderer there.
Absolutely.
The same thing would be the case.
Absolutely.
You have to let the fellow go. You don't want to reward them
for their
mistake, and therefore you have to turn the murderer loose.
That's correct. The Court of Appeals...
Otherwise, you'd be rewarding them for their mistake.
No, because we want to look out to the future to protect the other people. Sure, one murderer may...
You're not protecting anybody. These people are doing all that they possibly could.
I don't agree with that. I don't think the police did all they could.
Well, now you're arguing whether it was reasonable or not. But
I'm saying, assuming arguendo it was. I still believe, without any equivocation...
Who are you protecting then? They're going to make the same mistake in the future.
I'm protecting you when you go into your chambers, so when the police walk in for a warrant for Chief Justice Rehnquist, they don't bungle into yours by mistake.
They're going to make the same mistake because it was reasonable. Anybody would have made that mistake. It looked like one apartment. So how are you protecting me in the future? They're going to make exactly the same mistake.
Not if we set up new guidelines. For instance, let me address that. In a multiple dwelling unit where we have approximately, I would think, 60 to 70 million people that we're talking about, and these people live that way in multiple dwelling units. They leave the doors open. It's convenient. It's secure. Very often, unlike Mr. Sachs, perhaps, they drape their clothes over their doors. They do many things that you wouldn't do in your castle. Now, when the police come into a multiple dwelling unit, especially that unit, now let's look.
A buzzer goes off and says, I am a multiple dwelling unit. They didn't know it was a multiple dwelling.
Yes, they did. There were seven mailboxes and seven bells outside. That triggered it off. Here's what I'm saying. That this multiple dwelling unit, unlike one of the fine units you find in Washington where you have guards and each unit is separate, this is an old home. This is a home that used to be the residence of one person. So therefore, it doesn't have the same integrity or outward appearance as the wonderful new condominiums would.
You're arguing it was not a reasonable mistake then. I mean, if you want to argue that, that's fine. That's a miracle that this was not
a reasonable. I'm arguing obviously two ways. First, I'm arguing that I feel that the search was per se unreasonable because there was no warrant. If the court feels that I'm off base on there, then I retract, take one step back, and say I don't think the search itself, or not the search itself, but the actions of the police were reasonable. A solution when they walk into a multiple dwelling unit, especially ones in our cities that are absolutely inundated with multiple units. Indeed, some of them probably within themselves have rooms where boarders are rooming. The first thing they should do, and I don't think this is unreasonable, is to walk in, come up to this third floor, and instead of scanning out and searching and seizing, the first thing they do is detain Garrison and detain McWebb. Michigan versus Summer says they can. Fine, let's do that. Then fan out, walk through the apartments to see precisely where they are, also for their own protection. Walk through to make sure there is no one else hidden that's going to kill them. Walk through to make sure there isn't contraband being destroyed. So it serves a dual purpose. And when they walk through, and before they search and before they seize, they see the two kitchens. They see the bathrooms, and that triggers, we've got the wrong place. They stop there before they search and seize. Then they inquire.
Of just walking around for this security check, they see contraband.
Coolidge versus New Hampshire. If I'm saying that they have a right to walk in and they have a right to neutralize the premises and something is in plain view and it was stumbled upon as this...
Well, do you think they were rightfully in Garrison's apartment?
No. First, I argued no.
I thought you said they were.
Now, I said, if I have to retract that, I say as soon as they went through his threshold without probable cause for his apartment, they violated. If you feel I'm wrong, I step back and say the entry into...
Garrison's apartment was all right?
In what regard, sir?
Well, do you say it was all right to enter Garrison's apartment?
No, I do not. I say it's personally unreasonable because they didn't have a warrant for his apartment.
Oh, I know, but what about your fallback argument?
Fallback, I say if we allow them to walk in, we have to put some guidelines on them, some bridles. Can't let them just run around a multiple unit searching and seizing and arresting.
So if they find a... after walking around, as you say they could, on your fallback argument, they see a gun lying on the table, they can't seize it.
No. Gun, I don't think it's contraband.
You don't say that or not?
I say they cannot seize it because it is not contraband under Article 2736B of our Maryland law, for instance.
Let's get something else that
let's
is
Let's get
contraband.
Something that's obvious, heroin.
Yeah, all right. Well, you don't know really... you can't smell
Well, it's marked heroin and...
Yeah, it's got a sign.
Work. I mean, I'm trying to say, yes, if they truly...
The bag says plain view heroin.
Right, that's it. That's it. It's precisely what I was getting to, but then they can pick it up under Coolidge versus...
And seize it,
but stop the search.
All right.
Now go back to a magistrate where you've always urged the police to do. Get that neutral and detached magistrate and say, look what happened to us. While fanning out in this multiple unit, we discovered heroin marked, heroin, do not touch unless you're an addict. We then picked it up.
Sure.
Here it is. We want a warrant to search the rest. Why is that not the reasonable way to handle it?
Well, what's supposed to have been happening to the place while they went back to
the... They secured it. There were six people on the team, Chief Justice Rehnquist. They can secure that place. They can secure it. They can take Garrison and McWebb away, detain them all they want. Remember, criminals...
Now your position is that the warrant simply didn't cover Garrison.
That's correct.
If you're right, why can they take Garrison away?
Well, they can detain him.
Why?
Because you said so in your case of Michigan versus Summers. You said it's reasonable when you walk in and have probable cause. When you don't determine who Mr. Garrison is in his past, you can stop and detain him while you then go around searching.
Well, what
you have probable cause.
But I thought under your analysis there was no probable cause.
There's not. So I'm taking my one step back.
Will you wait till I finish my question,
yes,
please, and
yes,
slow down just a little?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that under your analysis there was no probable cause for entering Garrison's apartment.
That's correct, and I stand by that as my first proposition. If this court feels there was probable cause because they relied in good faith objectively on a warrant and had no way of knowing that it was not the correct McWebb apartment, then they walked in. So I'm saying at that point they had a right to walk through the threshold.
But where is there probable cause to arrest Garrison?
There's not. He's not arrested. He's detained.
Well, what is the level at which they have to detain him?
They have a warrant, which this court feels, many of the members, that should give the police the right to search. Certainly, if they have the right to go to the privacy, the search itself, they should have at least a right to detain. That's an infringement on his constitutional rights.
Your argument on this point is quite contrary to your argument in the rest of the case.
It is. Yes, it is. I agree with that. It's very contrary to the rest of the argument. I'm trying to find two positions. The position I'm trying to strive home to this court, we talk about the good faith reliance in Leon. To me, that, as a defense lawyer, I wasn't ecstatic with it, but it's reasonable. It's logical. It makes sense. Because, as I said, for 70 years, we've been urging the police to go to that neutral and detached magistrate. Seek him out. If he makes a mistake, if he doesn't apply the old Aguilar and Spinelli two-pronged test, that's not the policeman's fault. The policeman, armed in good faith, believing he has the right, comes in. So that makes sense to me. That, I believe, is reasonable.
Mr. Krupp,
yes.
What if the policeman who goes to get the warrant is acting on the basis of information given him by a reliable informant who happens to be wrong, dead wrong?
No.
But the informant says, you will find the marijuana in Mr. Garrison's apartment. A warrant is obtained for Garrison's apartment, and the police search pursuant to it. Now, that is a mistake made by the police.
That's correct.
You're going to hold that's okay.
I do not hold that okay. I still say if the police, apartment.
They get the warrant for the Garrison apartment,
yes.
But it's been a mistake made by the police and their informant.
Well, you've already touched on that, I believe, in the case of Franks versus Delaware.
Yeah, we've said that's all wrong.
That's okay.
So
and
that's
I can live with
a
that.
Case of a reasonable mistake that is comparable to what is being urged here, is it not?
I don't think it is. I don't think it's anywhere near the same, Your Honor, most respectfully. That informant said, go here and you'll find X, Y, and Z. They went to that location where the magistrate said, you go there. He did go there. But in our case,
you were taking the position that we had never permitted a mistake of fact on the part of the police or their informants.
Oh, you have.
To reach into the premises.
That's correct. I know of no case that allows that.
Well, Franks versus Delaware.
No, Franks versus Delaware did not. Franks versus Delaware allowed you to go beyond the four corners of the warrant to show that the police willfully and wantonly presented facts into the warrant. If the informant gives information that's totally, totally unreliable and not true, but the policeman in good faith believes that, you have sustained the warrant. I think, but remember, it goes to the special place. See, we're talking about the particularity clause. Remember, if we continue with the Fourth Amendment wording, and particularly describes the place to be searched or the person or property to be seized. He went beyond that. Even, if I recall, Justice White, in his Leon opinion, gave a caveat. He said, well, in the opinion that you wrote, Your Honor, that's correct. The caveat was that the particularity clause still must be served. You still, Mr. Constable, must go to the right place and seize the right person and the right things that I say you can. And in this case, they did not do that. So if it pleases the Court, there's no more questions. I thank the Court for the opportunity to present.
Let me just ask you one more.
Yes, sir.
Do you think the warrant would be valid if it had left out the reference to McWebb? What it says is he has reason to believe on the person of Webb there is so forth, and that on the premises known as 23 and so forth. If you left out all the references to the individual, but merely described the premises the way the premises are described, would you then make the same argument?
I think the argument, we'd have to look at the affidavit. If the affidavit was signed.
In the affidavit.
Pardon me?
The affidavit's written the same way.
Well, the affidavit mentions McWebb. Now, if the affidavit was totally silent, and they didn't know who they were looking for, I think there's a much stronger argument for this good faith or objective reasonableness. Yes, I do. I think that would make a difference, and maybe one day I'll be back to argue that. If I may, in light of the question, I still have time. I don't want to belabor this.
And while you're at it.
Yes, sir.
On your fallback argument, let's assume that it was proper to enter Garrison's apartment. At that point, they saw marijuana.
Well, again.
Well, that's what the.
That's correct.
And then they went ahead and that officer continued to search and found some other things.
But that marijuana does not give him the right to search.
But let's assume all he did was seize the marijuana.
Yes. Okay. That's correct. My fallback argument, Mr. Garrison could be convicted of marijuana.
Yes.
As it was, he was found guilty of the heroin
found
in his dresser drawer.
Exactly.
He shouldn't have had it.
Yes.
He wasn't obeying the law, but the officer shouldn't have been there to find it.
Oh.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Krupp. Mr. General Sachs, do you have any more? You have 5 minutes.
Just briefly, if I may, Mr. Chief Justice, the warrant was issued on the assumption that one third-floor apartment existed, and it was McWebb's. That assumption turned out to be a mistake. The issue, and the only issue, is whether that mistake was a reasonable one or not. With respect to Justice O'Connor's point with respect to Hill resulted in the search of a premises. It resulted in the kind of intrusion that Mr. Krupp was concerned about. It was permitted because, albeit it wasn't a Warren case, but it was permitted because the mistake in the belief that Miller was Hill was a reasonable one. It led to, under the then existing scope law, it led to the kind of search that we have here. The heart of the matter, and a per se test will not answer the question. Mr. Krupp, in effect, urges a per se test. If the warrant turns out to have been mistaken, it can never be good. It's only a conclusion to say it was warrantless or it was beyond the scope. The question that we must ask is, why was it, if you want to analyze it as warrantless, warrantless, and why was it, if you want to analyze it as beyond the scope, beyond the scope? The exceptions to the warrant requirement. The warrant requirement, warrants are presumptively reasonable. Not to have one is presumptively unreasonable. But all of the exceptions to the warrant requirement result in warrantless searches, which are held by this Court to be reasonable because exigent, because hot pursuit, because
General
consent.
General Sachs, with respect to your first argument, not the good faith one, is your argument, you think, entirely consistent with Massachusetts against Shepard? Wasn't the same sort of defect in the warrant there, just kind of somebody bungled a little bit?
Well, I read Massachusetts against Shepard, Mr. Justice Stevens, as a defect of law. This was a legally invalid warrant. This Court has held that.
But for the same sort of reason that you have here, there's kind of a mechanical error.
Well, it falls in a sort of a sui generis category that some could call a technical error. I don't think it's our burden to have to define whether it was or was not a technical error, but it's very distinguishable from this case. It was not a mistake in the assumptions and facts that led to the signing and the execution of the warrant. It was a ministerial mistake, perhaps, in the putting together of the papers for the warrant, for which the police have been held by this Court not to be responsible.
General, suppose it was perfectly clear there were two apartments on the third floor, and everybody knew it at the time the warrant was issued. But all you knew was that drugs were being sold out of the third floor. And everybody concedes there was probable cause to believe that drugs were being sold out of the third floor. But they didn't know which apartment. And the warrant then authorized the search of both apartments.
It doesn't sound to me in your hypothetical, Mr. Justice, that you have described sufficient probable cause to enter two persons' places just because one of them, this is the lady in the tiger, just because one of them is likely to be dealing drugs. Mm-hmm. That is not this case. Mm-hmm. This case is bottomed on the assumption, reasonable we say, that only McWebb lived on that floor and there was only one apartment on that floor. If we're wrong about that, if that was unreasonable, then the Court of Appeals was right, but for the wrong reasons, because it never asked the question nor did it analyze it. In asking ourselves this question, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the Court, we posited the Halloween prank. Suppose that the numbers on all the doors on the 2000 block of Park Avenue were changed reasonably and looking good so that an objective observer couldn't tell the difference, and the police simply went into the wrong house and found heroin. That's a terrible intrusion on the innocent victims, not so innocent in terms of heroin, but innocent in terms of any probable cause of that search. And we come to the conclusion, and I hope by using this hypothetical I make the right assumption about what this Court would do, there's nothing the police did wrong. There's nothing unreasonable about their conduct. That is Hill, and that is this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, General Sachs. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.